Hello, it's Thursday 17th of June. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowman of Check In Asia and I are really excited to welcome Nick Ray, principal at Hanuman Films, Lonely Planet writer and tourism consultant with the World Bank. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today we're excited to be talking all things travel, tourism, and filmmaking with Nick Ray, principal at Hanuman Films, a longtime Lonely Planet writer for Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and as Hannah said, a tourism consultant with the World Bank. So Nick, thanks very much for coming on the show. How are you going today, and where are you? Because you're not actually in Cambodia, are you?
Thank you so much, Gary and Hannah, for having me on the show. That's true. I'm not actually in Cambodia. I'm in Nam, but that's Cheltenham in the UK rather than Vietnam.
And what are you doing there, Nick?
I'm over here for a short time to see family and friends, because obviously with the travel world being grounded for so long, it's been perhaps nearly 18 months since I was home. So it's time to check in on my parents and make some connections again.
Right. So that segues neatly into our first question. We've got so much to talk about over the next 30 minutes. So let's get cracking. Nick, born and educated in the UK, but you've been in Cambodia for over two decades, I think. What first brought you there and what encouraged you to stay?
Well, I think I was very fascinated, strangely, from a young age in Cambodia, because there was a children's show that you may recall called Blue Peter. And Blue Peter actually had a famine appeal for what was then Kampuchea in 1979 and 1980. So you had to kind of sell some of your toys or your clothes and raise money for the people of Cambodia. So I got involved in that. So the whole idea of Cambodia or Kampuchea stuck in my head early. I also had a set of encyclopedias given to me by a grandfather. And you know, as a kid, you're not that interested in encyclopedias, sorry to say, or at least I wasn't. And I only got as far as A, but luckily that took me to Angkor and the Angel Falls. And I made it to Angkor, but not yet the Angel Falls. And then when I went to university, I studied history and politics. So, of course, you know, the Vietnam War, the Cambodia sideshow and all that happened during that period was very interesting for me. So when I did a big travel trip after university, Cambodia featured strongly as part of that Southeast Asia adventure. And I think what really captivated me was obviously the history, that kind of glorious history of Angkor and the, you know, the Khmer Empire and how it was able to sort of plant its identity on the whole Southeast Asia region, but then also the tragic modern history and what happened during the Khmer Rouge period and the Civil War. But of course, also the Cambodian people, you know, as many people have seen or heard over during their visits, you know, they're some of the friendliest in Southeast Asia, if not the world. And it's very easy to engage and interact with them. So I think that played a big role as well.
So that first trip, Nick, that must have been a few years ago. When was it? And I guess it was a very different Cambodia that you experienced back then.
Absolutely. The first trip was 1995. So kind of, you know, almost pre-internet or pre-email, if you like, for many people. So that was the days of post-restaurant and genuine sort of disconnection from your home and your circle. So it really was. I mean, it was still quite edgy back then. It was the Civil War. The last phase was still rumbling on. Pol Pot was still alive. So you had to be very careful. You couldn't, for example, travel by road between Phnom Penh and Siem Reap. You had to travel by boat. So it really, compared with the Cambodia of today, it really was a completely different world. And of course, you know, there's been a huge amount of progress. A lot of people like to romanticize the old days and being first through the door. That was wonderful for the temples, but of course it wasn't so good for safety, infrastructure and all those other things.
That's true. And so you're a writer for many of the Lonely Planet travel guys. And I actually, when I saw that we were going to be interviewing you, I went and checked out who my Cambodia Lonely Planet guide was written by, sitting on my bookshelf, and it was by you. So you've written, you know, that really iconic Southeast Asia on a shoestring. You've been doing this since 1998. So you must have seen travel guide publishing world go through many different iterations. What do you see its future being right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, obviously, when I started back in 98 was my first Lonely Planet guidebook. That was, yeah, as you mentioned, Southeast Asia on a shoestring, the Cambodia chapter. I mean, really, in a way, the Lonely Planet guides were the Bible, if you like, the travel Bible. So, you know, there were, because there wasn't much information yet on the just developing or emerging internet, everyone had a travel guide, you know, literally. Almost everyone you saw, particularly in Southeast Asia, because of course that's where Lonely Planet started. You know, the first book across Asia on the cheap, and then the first regional book was Southeast Asia on a shoestring in 1975. So what I think what's happened obviously is the switch to digital. So, you know, more and more things now are online, and there's, you know, whether it's TripAdvisor, whether it's other sites. There's so much information out there, but I think there's still a big role for the guidebook because, of course, it's curated content. So it's, you know, it's been selected by so-called travel experts like myself on the ground, and we've really taken the hard work or the legwork out of it for you. You know, I mean, personally myself, when I have to sift through TripAdvisor reviews, you know, I don't know who's that person who's reviewing it. And my famous frustration is when you read something like, you know, undoubtedly the best hotel in Siem Reap, where you're like, how many have you stayed in during your visit? You know, we actually have to inspect them and visit them and compare them. So I think there's still a very big role for curated content. And I think that the kind of death of publishing is very premature. You know, there's been, before the pandemic at least, and perhaps during, there's been quite a comeback of print once more. And I think there is a place for guidebooks. One thing I see as a trend is obviously parents that traveled in the 80s and 90s with their now grown up children. You know, what a great present if they're going off traveling. Take this guidebook with you, you know, it'll keep you safe. I think people like reading on, you know, on buses, on trains, on long transport, and reading devices can, you know, after a while, it's pretty tiring. Whereas having a book that you can leaf through, make notes in, pull pages out, you know, that's a really important part of the travel experience for me, I would say, when I was doing it. And I think it can be for this current generation as well. So I think, you know, guidebooks will continue to be there and continue to sell, but I do think they're going to have to be a bit more nimble about how they interact with their digital content. So in other words, that, you know, the guidebook's kind of your pass, if you like, or your membership to perhaps some better content and some sort of paid privileges, if you like. So, you know, everyone can have access to the Lonely Planet website, but if you buy the book, you're going to get some extra tips, some extra tricks, and some extra content. I think that would make sense.
Yeah, I largely agree with you there, Nick. I was actually a rough guides writer. My first guide was a year after you, 1999. I did Central America, I did El Salvador and Nicaragua. And I was actually following around the Lonely Planet writer. So we actually caught up a couple of times. But it was funny, wherever I would go, they would say, well, weren't you here last week? I said, no, there's a difference between Lonely Planet and Rough Guide. And so, you know, in some of the more remote places, they didn't really understand the difference. But I mean, I had great times researching that book. It was fantastic. And I guess you must have had some pretty unforgettable memories on those early LP research trips. Can you remember any of those?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of my first memories, of course, is a strange one, but it's very interesting for younger listeners that just didn't grow up in the world of, you know, things like post-restant and pre-internet. So we have something called reader's letters. Well, they were then. They'd now be called reader's emails, of course. And basically, these were, you know, feedback from the readers about, you know, tips, tricks, ideas, corrections. And I had to collect these from the Bangkok post office before I flew into Cambodia in April 98. And it was an enormous box, you know. They passed me this huge box and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, I'm traveling around with a rucksack and I've got to fly into Cambodia. So I kind of had to sift through them and sort of, you know, cross out bits I didn't need and duplicates and things like that. So that was, you know, now, of course, you just get a kind of simple file and attachment and just flick through it. It's much better organized in a database and it's much easier to transport. I mean, in terms of the travel, one of my favorite memories from that first trip was Bokor Hill Station, Bokor National Park. This is near Kampot down on the south coast. And Kampot's now a hugely popular destination with the local market, but also with, you know, international travelers. Like, it's kind of really become a super cool place for hipsters. It's got a cafe scene, a restaurant scene, and looming above it is Bokor National Park, which rises up to 1,000 meters. And this was abandoned several times in the 1940s and again in the 1970s due to conflict. And up there is this amazing hotel and casino right on the edge of the cliff. And so to get up there, it'd been off limits until about the beginning of April 98. And I managed to get permission to go up there just as it was reopening. So they just flushed out the last Khmer Rouge units that were up there. And I could go up there on a dirt bike with a couple of friends. So we set off, and basically the road was so overgrown with long grasses and vines and things that it was like a footpath, not a road. And so we drove up for 2 hours or more on this bumpy old French sort of disintegrating stone road. And we eventually emerged on this plateau with all these incredible abandoned buildings, like an old French church, like an old casino, an old hotel. It was even, I mean, to give you an idea of how iconic it was, they were looking at it for that one of the Bond films in 1970 before the Cambodian Civil War kicked off. So, you know, it really was a place when Cambodia was on the travel map of the 1960s. So we're up there on our own, just looking around thinking, wow, you know, just 2 weeks ago or a month ago, the Khmer Rouge were here. So 98 was an amazing time to be there because it was Cambodia in transition. You know, literally, I was in the Foreign Correspondents Club in Phnom Penh when Pol Pot's death was announced. So, you know, you had these famous journalists like Tim Page at the bar, Philip Griffith Jones, you know. So for me, as a young wannabe writer, it was just an incredible time.
So you're now the location manager, producer and director for Hanuman Films, which is a film production company based in Cambodia. How has that affected you? How's COVID-19 impacted your work over the past year? Are things starting to look brighter?
Yeah, I mean, COVID's obviously been difficult for everybody in almost every industry, perhaps unless you're in delivery or things like that. But that's for most of us, it's been pretty tough. And film production's obviously been pretty much as affected as the travel industry. So obviously, people have been able to carry on shooting in the UK for the UK industry or the US for the US industry, but they just really haven't been able to travel very easily because of safety protocols, because of quarantines and so on. For us, obviously, most of our market was normally servicing international productions and making some of our own. So there were two problems there. International productions couldn't get in, so that was difficult. And obviously, budget-wise, there was no money for our kind of local productions that we normally do in terms of narrative stories and features and things. So what we did was really pivot to the local market in terms of working on commercials with big companies like Cellcard, one of the leading mobile companies. We did several big projects for them, including the One Nation commercial at Prayer Vihear Temple. International organizations, people like the EU, USAID, AFD, the French government NGO. So we've sort of done educational films, we've done tourism films, we did, which has just been released actually, and is doing the rounds very successfully, Taste Cambodia, which is the official promotional film for the Ministry of Tourism. So that's just come out. So we kept pretty busy. It was different from what we normally do, but actually it's put us in a very good position when things open up again, because then rather than be reliant only on the international market, we also now have a very solid local market. The other thing we did that was really good, which we in the industry we call it remote shooting, we actually did the only piece of live travel content for the BBC travel show. So during the first lockdown, March till June last year, the team of the travel show could not travel. It was all done on webcams from home or repeats, so kind of not that exciting for the audience. So we got in touch with them because of our long partnership with the BBC, and we said, look, we're here, we can do a piece on Empty Angkor and Siem Reap without tourists. So they actually commissioned a segment which ran in May last year, which was great.
Fantastic. And you also finished shooting an episode of Locked Up Abroad in Cambodia for National Geographic, is that correct?
Yes, it nearly became Locked Down Abroad because the crew had to go into quarantine, obviously, for 2 weeks on arrival because there's no exceptions at this time, but more on that later. But that was very tricky. But it also, you know, it coincided with Cambodia's hardest moment in terms of the pandemic. So, you know, we did so well for the best part of a year. We had no community cases from, I think it was May till November last year, zero community transmission. And we had no deaths. Our first death was only on about the 11th of March. And even today, we've only had 40,000 cases. And we've had, I say only, it's still a tragedy, of course, but only around under 350 deaths. So Cambodia is a real pandemic success story, but that's not widely known. But then we did have this period where numbers began to spike in April. And of course, that's when our crew arrived. And basically, we just had this domino effect of restrictions coming in. So we had a travel ban on traveling between provinces, which was pretty difficult when we needed to go from Phnom Penh to Siem Reap. We had an alcohol ban, which is never popular with film crews. Then we had an actual lockdown. So we actually went into only a short one. I think it was 3 weeks in the end, a snap lockdown. But this made things extra difficult. I mean, filming is always challenging. But this became our biggest challenge to date, if you like, based on 20 years of film experience. So we actually got very special permission. We had a signed paper from the Phnom Penh governor to be allowed to travel. So it was kind of like, I guess, you know, the green zone in Baghdad back in the days. You know, we had to go over the Japanese bridge and go into these kind of secure gates and show paperwork and move on. And we went through two or three of those checkpoints and eventually got to Siem Reap. Once in Siem Reap, things were generally easier because they didn't have a lockdown, but they did still have restrictions like an 8 p.m. curfew. And of course, a lot of our shooting was nighttime. I mean, I can't give you too many details about the show, but for those listeners that know it, you know, it's basically about people that get jailed overseas. And by a combination of interviews and flashbacks, we then recreate the drama of what happened. So this was actually set in Thailand. And so we needed, like, you know, bars, we needed things to look busy and normal pre-pandemic. So that was all quite challenging. But yes, eventually we got it shot after about a week of scouting and a week of shooting. And it's quite an incredible thought. You know, I still have to sort of pinch myself and think, yes, we actually managed to shoot an episode of international television during a pandemic in a lockdown in Cambodia.
There we go. I think that shows how resilient I think you guys have managed to be and how nimble during the pandemic. You've worked on a ton of iconic film productions, one of them being Tomb Raider. You know, how did you find and select the locations for that? Or how did you go about that in general?
Okay, for Tomb Raider, if I'm being honest, the locations were quite easy. I mean, I'd love to claim all the glorious credit, but, you know, Angkor Wat, Bayon, Ta Prohm, you know, you'd have to be a pretty bad location scout and manager to miss those. So basically, that was my first big gig. So before that, the only television show we'd done was actually what used to be Lonely Planet TV and is now Pilot Guides, Globetrekker and things like that on Discovery. So we did like a four-person, five-person crew, like a Cambodia show with them as basically fixers, if you like. And then suddenly we found ourselves working on Tomb Raider, you know, a massive Hollywood production. We had 150 people fly in from America and the UK, and we had like 500 extras on some days. Just a massive, massive production. So finding the locations there was easy. It's a lot more difficult for some other productions. Like I worked on Two Brothers, the Jean-Jacques Annaud film about tigers around the temples. And there we had to go to very remote places like Prea Khan, Kompong Svai, Bante Chamar, you know, Krachay, Kampot, finding old colonial buildings and so on. So different projects have different briefs and different needs. So, I mean, what I love about being a location scout, the thing that the real buzz of it is when you get that treatment or script, you know, the trust to share, you know, for a big director to share a script with you and you sign your non-disclosure agreement and so on. But then your mind starts whirring and the cogs go and you find the places that match that description. And it's really rewarding when you're on the ground with a well-known director like, Jean-Jacques Annaud being a famous one. I also worked with Chivo, the famous DOP, director of photography. He's the one that won 3 Oscars in a row. So Gravity, Birdman, Revenant, you know, this is the cameraman's cameraman. So I worked with him on the Guerlain commercial with Angelina Jolie a couple of years ago. And again, going around the temples with him, just on, you know, myself and him on our own at out of visitor hours, just incredible. And seeing how he takes pictures and what he thinks about. So when you know you're kind of hitting the spot for these film legends, it's really an amazing experience.
Yeah, Tomb Raider, Angelina Jolie. I mean, that's quite a famous example of how, you know, movies have made tourism destinations so popular. I think another one probably in our region is Lost in Thailand in Chiang Mai, which is widely heralded as a sort of really kickstarting the Chinese outbound travel surge to Thailand in recent years. So we've seen the impact, both positive and less positive, that filming locations can have in terms of driving tourist visits. So what role do you see film production companies can play in a sort of sustainable revival of tourism after the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Lord of the Rings is a great example in New Zealand of what happened there. I mean, Tomb Raider itself in Cambodia, it certainly played a big part in those early days, I think, because it was, you know, a big film with a very big name, Angelina Jolie. But also people forget Daniel Craig, James Bond, had a small part in it as a kind of love interest. So you actually had James Bond and Lara Croft together in the same film. But it's, you know, the tour guides, even today at Ta Prohm, you know, they still call it the Tomb Raider Temple and they still go to the Tomb Raider tree. And you hear all these kind of half-invented or embellished stories. I sometimes wander around there with high-end tour groups that I lecture and things like that. And I'm kind of listening in on the side and think, don't think that happened. But anyway, nice story. But I think that, you know, it's certainly, I think in the future that film productions can play a big role in drawing people to iconic locations. And I think that's something that filmmakers can do more of, is actually thinking of the impact the locations they choose and how they use those locations could actually play out. I mean, another example that we just had recently, I mentioned it because it's literally just come out through Paramount. We did a film called Infinite, which has just come out with starring Mark Wahlberg. And basically, that's a very interesting trend for the future, because actually the production didn't come to Cambodia, only a very small digital capture team. So they basically came to Cambodia, used a mixture of LiDAR and cameras and surveys, very low impact, didn't affect tourists, just got on with it around Angkor Wat and created a digital model, if you like, of Angkor Wat, which then features beautifully in the backdrop to the film. But, you know, in the old days, that would have involved like Tomb Raider, you know, 150 people traveling in, lots of complications and so on. But obviously, as the nature of production changes, I think we'll see more and more digitization. And that's good and bad. Of course, it's not so good for the location in terms of spend on the ground. However, it's going to be easier to show some of these iconic locations in countries that are quite inaccessible. So, you know, you want to film in, I don't know, Congo or Somalia, you're not going to take a crew there, but maybe you can send in a small digital capture team with the right security in place and get some of these incredible locations.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So you're very heavily involved in the tourism industry in Cambodia. Take us through the current situation right now. What's happening with domestic travel and what's the current vaccination situation? Because they seem to be vaccinating people really rapidly.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I mean, first on the domestic side, I mean, domestic travel has been very strong during the past year and through the pandemic. I mean, as I said, because we had zero community cases for 6 months last year, you know, it was very open. You know, bars were open, nightclubs were open, destinations were open. You could kind of go anywhere and do anything. I mean, we lived in a normal bubble that we, you know, we couldn't really understand how hard things were in other countries. When I spoke to family and friends, you know, they couldn't believe how fortunate we were. So that domestic travel at the moment is mainly obviously focused on weekends and national holidays. But the big problem is it just can't fill the black hole in international tourism. You know, that's estimated to be worth around $5 billion a year to Cambodia. And that's a big hole to plug in the national budget. It's something like 20% of GDP when you include the value chains like agriculture and transport. But on the positive side, the vaccine situation, as you mentioned, is incredible. I mean, really, I mean, I have to stress it. Sorry if I get too enthusiastic, but it really is, you know, talk about small country, big heart. The way Cambodia's managed this is really off the radar for most parts of the world. It's not in the news, but they're doing really well. So basically, they're second only to Singapore in terms of percentage of the population vaccinated. They've already done 30% first doses and 25% second doses. But that's because that's all focused around Phnom Penh, where the main outbreaks have been during this recent community outbreak. They've now done about 90 to 95% first doses in Phnom Penh and 70% second doses. So basically, the Phnom Penh vaccination campaign ends in mid-July. So I think that at that point, Phnom Penh will be basically the most vaccinated capital city in Southeast Asia, possibly one of the most in the world. And the Prime Minister has just announced, I think it was in yesterday's news, that they're on track according to the number of doses ordered and arriving on schedule constantly, Sinovac, Sinopharm, for 70% in vaccination by November, or the magical herd immunity, as they call it. So that's really a big good news story for Cambodia. And now what we need is the reopening plan to keep pace with the vaccination rollout.
Yeah, the reopening plan is in formation, I guess. Hannah and I were on a call last week with the Cambodian Tourism Board, and they said they are looking at Q4. They're looking at package tourists from vaccinated low and medium risk countries. But there's not much more detail on the outside at the moment. Is there any more detail that you're hearing from the inside?
Yes, I can give you some inside scoops. There's a twin track here. There's obviously what's being planned by elements in the government, but there's also what's being pushed for by elements of the private sector. And obviously, I'm sort of have a hand in both, but I'm much more involved in the private sector and trying to basically lobby the government to open up. So we've had some big meetings with some of the key ministries, Ministry of Tourism, Ministry of Economics and Finance, and so on. And they're very open to listening to private sector concerns. And I suppose for us, what we really need is a timetable to the removal of quarantine. You know, we need planning. You know how it is in the tourism industry. A lot of people are booking 6 months to a year ahead. And so we can't, you know, with things like the lockdown in Cambodia, they were announced perhaps the evening before with 3 hours notice. You know, you can't do that with a travel industry that's responsible for 20% of the economy. So what at the moment we're pushing for, and we're having a lot of meetings with this and it's gaining traction, is we're not asking them to open Cambodia tomorrow or even next month. We're saying if we're confident that the health situation and the vaccination situation by Q4 is the 70% we've talked about, then we have to have a roadmap to reopening that's very clear. So we have to know when quarantine will be reduced, perhaps to first a week or even then to 2 days, and when it will be completely removed. And we're arguing that certainly when it comes to reopening, there has to be no quarantine, because we feel, and I'm sure many in the travel industry agree, that that's a deal breaker for tourists. If there's other destinations that are open without quarantine, why would you choose a destination with quarantine? So we're saying that for fully vaccinated travelers that can show proof of vaccine, by Q4, you should be able to come into Cambodia and travel freely, because according to the government, by then also 70% of the local population will have been vaccinated. And what we've got to remember is that the vaccines will roll out in the urban areas first. So basically half of the Cambodian population, more than, never meet a tourist. You know, the people in Svay Rieng, Tuong Kmum, Odar Minche, these kind of provinces that are heavily populated in some cases, they never meet tourists. So it's also about being realistic about risk management. You know, as long as Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, Sihanoukville, Kampot, you know, you've vaccinated all the key towns and then some of the key focal points, like perhaps community-based ecotourism places or certain lodges in remote areas, then I think, you know, there isn't particularly a major risk to worry about. What we don't want to do in Cambodia is kind of flip-flop like other destinations that I won't name, but we know some of them. We don't want to keep announcing opening, closing. Cambodia, I think, you know, they're being cautious, but if we get this right, this is a really big story. So we want to base it on the timetable, the vaccine rollout, and try and coordinate all of this to have a very clear timetable that we actually stick to. But the really important thing for us to stress, which you'd imagine from the Cambodian tourism industry side, is this has got to be communicated. The decision needs to be made soon, and it's got to be communicated internationally, because the vaccine rollout's a great story. And of course, the free marketing potential for Cambodia, if they get this right and announce it correctly, this is big news and could help Cambodia reinvent itself as a standalone destination.
There was one good point you made there, Nick, which I thought was excellent, when you're saying about the vaccination, how it needs to be a national rollout. Because Cambodia is one of the countries, I guess, in our region particularly, where tourism is very concentrated, isn't it, in certain centres. But you've got to make sure that residents are safe and healthy everywhere across the country, not just in the places that tourists are going to visit.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. I mean, because the government's priority is to protect its local population, as it should be. You know, that's what many governments have put in place. But the vaccine is obviously changing the dynamic, we hope, of how that works. And so, but yes, you can't leave anyone behind. I mean, obviously in the countryside, perhaps they may find more resistance, you know, that people don't want the vaccine because of misunderstandings about, you know, different aspects of the rollout and how it works. There is some suspicion due to a lack of education in some areas. That's natural. And it was initially that there was some vaccine hesitancy in the cities. And there's been some really good government and, you know, WHO and other organization sponsored campaigns with, you know, big digital video billboards, basically kind of showing these videos with famous actors and actresses kind of discussing the vaccine and, you know, somebody being suspicious and hesitant and the other one explaining that they've had it. And so this is really important in a country where people rely on Facebook and social media for news. And of course, there's a lot of fake news. It's very, very important to make sure that the messaging about the, you know, safe vaccines and the safe rollout and why this is important for the country and the future of many, many people in the country is, you know, that's a critical message to get across.
Absolutely. So what do you think some of the biggest challenges are going to be facing Cambodia as it looks to reopen to inbound travellers?
Well, I think one obvious one will be flights, because, you know, a lot of flights have been suspended or cancelled and Cambodia is very reliant on regional gateways. Phnom Penh still got pretty good connections because of business travel, government travel, family and friends. But Siem Reap, this is really important to remember, Siem Reap hasn't seen an international flight since the 26th of March 2020. That's a hell of a long time for an airport that might normally see 30 or 40 flights a day. So that's going to take longer to rebuild, because, of course, airlines are going to sort of fill up the planes that are flying to Phnom Penh first, naturally. Why, you know, if you're already flying a Singapore Airlines or Korean Air or whoever is flying a route to Phnom Penh already and it's only half full or a quarter full, you might as well sell those seats before you start adding seats to Siem Reap. So airlines and flights will be a big challenge. And obviously we need some of our neighbours to open up a bit more to help us, like, you know, Thailand and Thai Airways would be very useful, Vietnam and Vietnam Airlines. So that's one factor. Another one, I think, is marketing and promotion, because, you know, we know the big hitters in the region, you know, your Thailands and Malaysias will be able to spend their way out of the crisis and into recovery. They'll have budgets of $100 million or more a year. Cambodia hasn't got that. They may have had a $5 million budget before the pandemic. That may now be a $2 million or $3 million budget. So this goes back to this timetable to reopening. This really needs to be communicated, rolled out, communicated, because this is a huge free marketing opportunity for Cambodia.
And Nick, we have to ask you, when we talk about Cambodia, what about China? China, obviously, such an important market, both in terms of tourists, both in terms of commercial links between the two countries. How important is it for Cambodia that China would allow its tourists to come back to Cambodia?
Yeah, that's a big debate that's going on, because obviously there's a sense that in the Chinese mainland at the moment that they're discouraging outbound tourism. I think there's a couple of reasons there. One is obviously strongly wanting to keep out variants. I mean, they've got the big problem in Guangzhou now, as you know, with the so-called Delta variant. So they're very conscious because they've done very well, you know, after the initial stages of the pandemic and the possible origins. Once they got it under control, China in general has done very well. So they want to keep that under control. And also, of course, they've got the Winter Olympics coming up, I think February next year. So they also want that not to be interrupted or disrupted in any way, because we see the issues facing Tokyo right now. So I think that, you know, that, but I don't know how widely known that is, say, in Cambodian government circles or, you know, among other markets. So the key is that China is important and it will continue to be very important for Cambodia. You only have to visit Sihanoukville to see that, which is going to be a huge beach destination for Chinese travelers in the future. But maybe not yet. So, you know, if you're the government and looking at planning, I would really be encouraging them to look at the most vaccinated markets and the long haul winter markets. And they tend to coincide at the point of USA, UK, Europe, because they've, you know, they will have all been vaccinated by Q4, and they really will want to get away for winter because, you know, they've had the harsh lockdown winter that they've already been through. So I think, and they won't have traveled long haul this summer because they'll be just looking at Europe and, you know, the backyard, if you like. So I think there's a real opportunity for somewhere like Cambodia to welcome those long haul markets with open arms in the winter.
Yeah, agreed. I think a lot of, not only Cambodia, but I think governments within Southeast Asia are pinning a lot of hopes on China, are pinning a lot of hopes on regional travel, and actually they should be looking at these long-haul, fully vaccinated markets instead. So switching track a little bit now and to ecotourism, and that's something that you consult for the World Bank. How have you seen ecotourism developing in Cambodia over the years?
Yeah, I mean, so for the World Bank, I'm working on a project called the Cambodia Sustainable Landscape and Ecotourism Project. So it covers the Cardamom Mountains in the southwest of Cambodia, one of the biggest protected areas in Southeast Asia and a real biodiversity hotspot. And it also covers areas around the Tonle Sap, so some of the flooded forest, the floating villages, and of course the very important sacred mountain of Phnom Kulen near Siem Reap. So it's a really interesting geographic area that the project's covering. I think ecotourism in Cambodia is really beginning to take off, or at least it was before the pandemic. And on the domestic side, that's really done well during the pandemic. Cambodians have begun to explore their protected areas and national parks all over the country, sharing selfies, you know, sharing videos. They've really taken to trekking, which wasn't a big thing with Cambodians, if I'm being very honest, you know, because obviously working in tourism for many years, I've done lots of trekking, but it was sometimes hard to find tour guides that really embraced it or wanted to do it. But lots of young Cambodians are now trekking. They're camping overnight in beauty spots on the edge of the Cardamoms, you know, with viewpoints from cliffs and rolling mountains. And also they're mountain biking. Like, you go to the one really interesting thing around Angkor now is, you know, in the old days you had traffic jams of tour buses around, say, the south gate of Angkor Thom at 5 o'clock, and that wasn't very pleasant. Now you have, well, they're not really traffic jams because it's a very nice site, but you've got clusters of mountain bikes. Locals are on mountain bikes at all, you know, early morning, late evening, and everyone's jumping onto bicycles and mountain bikes and cycling around the temples. So in a way, that's a nice sort of byproduct of the pandemic, if there are any positives, which is Cambodians have almost reclaimed the temples as their own. So it's really become a Cambodia destination. I mean, more generally, looking at international travelers in the post-pandemic world, I think, yeah, ecotourism is going to be a big thing. You know, it's wide open spaces, get up close and personal with nature. You know, it, I think it ticks all the boxes for kind of, you know, social distancing and sort of mindfulness after the pandemic. And I think, you know, so Cambodia is in a good position there because, you know, they have the Cardamom Mountains, which is very unexplored, but with some great accommodation like Cardamom Tenti Camp, Shintamani Wild if your budget's unlimited, Chipat for homestays if you're a backpacker. But then you've also got places like Mondulkiri, you know, where you have Elephant Valley Project, Jahu Gibbon Camp. So there's a real growing emerging ecotourism sector in Cambodia, and I think it's going to be very attractive if we look at this trend towards slow travel and possibly single destination travel after the pandemic. You know, people maybe don't want to come and do Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos all in 14 days, in and out of airports, in and out of countries with different regulations. I think more and more people will go, okay, where's a good country I can go for 2 weeks? And I think Cambodia's really in a very good position if they get the messaging right and if they have this timetable to reopening clearly communicated. Because, you know, Cambodia is or should be a standalone destination. You know, for a lot of the UK market, for example, it is. People do come for 10 days or 2 weeks. But particularly, say, for example, the American market, you know, it's like a 2 day or 3 day hit and run on Siem Reap and Angkor. And that's a little bit of a tragedy, really. You know, it's really underselling the country because Cambodia has so much to offer.
You mentioned, Nick, that there's this roadmap that, may be put together in terms of sort of pre-advertising what could happen in Cambodia in future. Do you think this element of actually promoting Cambodia as a single destination, as promoting the sort of health and well-being aspects, the transformational tourism aspects, so there could actually be quite a shift in the way that Cambodia presents itself?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, obviously, I can't speak for the government and the Ministry of Tourism, but certainly the private sector will encourage them to go down this road. You know, you can't only focus on one type of tourism or one tourism market. You need to be open and flexible and nimble to all. I think, obviously, visitors will play a big part in this. They will drive some of this themselves in what they're demanding in terms of products and experiences. So I think that's where, you know, whether it's clean travel, green travel, sustainable, responsible, all these different things will become key elements of planning a trip. And I think this is where, you know, DMCs, destination management companies and tour operators will be in a good position, because they can obviously really work with their international partners, you know, the big companies overseas, like the Audley Travels of this world. Companies can work with them to deliver what the clients or the guests in the West are looking for. I think, you know, guidebooks and travel websites will also play a part. There's obviously going to be a move to this sort of cleaner, more sustainable travel, this, as you say, transformational tourism. So I do think it's important the government researches more about this, learns more about it, and gets on board, because, you know, they're definitely doing a good job of promoting ecotourism in the recovery, and that's very much front and center of the messaging they'll be putting out towards reopening and recovery. But as you say, there's much more to that. I mean, ecotourism is just one element of sustainable tourism. So I think we need to look at the big picture and see what Cambodia can offer that's perhaps some of its neighbors can't offer, and what's different. You know, unique selling points are going to become very important in post-pandemic recovery. And I do think Cambodia's got a lot of them. And obviously, a lot of people will be drawn to Angkor. It's always going to be a centerpiece of Cambodian tourism. And the idea of seeing empty Angkor, or Angkor before the rest of the tourists come back, that's a great kind of catch to bring you to Cambodia. But then once you come, well, stay a while, stick around for 10 days or 2 weeks and see what else the country offers, because it's an amazing place.
It is. There's very little good that has come out of COVID-19. But if one of the goods is that Cambodia can be seen as a single destination, a destination in its own right, I think, well, maybe not quite a lay for everything, but at least go a little way to bring some good out of all of this. So, Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a really interesting half an hour or so, going from everything, right, from film to Cambodia to sustainable tourism. If our listeners want to find more of you, where can they find you?
That's a good question. I try and keep a low profile. No, I mean, the obvious place to see some of the work we're doing, I mean, is the Hanuman Films. There's a Facebook page. There's also a YouTube site with lots of videos, including, for example, the Taste Cambodia videos I was talking about for the Ministry of Tourism. So a lot of our production work is on the Hanuman Films YouTube page. And obviously, if you're thinking of travel in Q4 or beyond, then Lonely Planet, you know, they're a great company still. Love working with them. It's been, I think, 23 years and counting now. But, you know, they still pay to send real writers out to do real travel on the ground. And hence the information you get in that guidebook, you know, as I said, it's the curated content. It cuts out some of the legwork for you. And, you know, the author voice can be quite a nice traveling companion to go with you. I can promise you, if you buy the Cambodia Lonely Planet, there's a lot of good tips in there, particularly some great bars recommended, and also some really cool new up and coming ecotourism gems which are emerging in the pandemic world.
Perfect. And I'll drop the links to that in our show notes on the website too. So Nick, thank you so much for coming on. And that brings us to the end of today's show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Nick or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please remember to rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for today. And we look forward to talking more Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.